Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you once again, Audrey, for getting us going on this radio show number 8,221. No, it just seems like that. But thank you very much, Audrey. We could not do it without you. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show specifically. I'm your host, Keith Haley, and Johnny Cash again takes us on that trip across the United States where he visits 90 cities and states. If you hear all the lyrics to that particular song. I'm beginning to worry about Johnny, though, if he's going to be out hitchhiking now. And after the president's speech tonight, we're going to have so many people employed, and we're going to manufacture so much stuff. There's going to be so many trucks out there, so it's going to be dangerous, Johnny. Take it easy and ride with good drivers only. Emily and Mike, we want to thank you very much. By the way, Mike, this is the first time since we've been doing this radio show, I didn't know that you could clog. And you went right off on Johnny Cash's song there and did a little bit of clogging. Ladies and gentlemen, I wish we had a webcam for that, but we don't. So Mike is a clogger, and we never knew that. The purpose of this show is to take a look at some news and some issues and events that happen in criminal justice, and it's a difficult and humorous field. And tonight we're going to do a little history. I'll give you a little pre-tip on what we're going to do. We're going to be studying Bonnie and Clyde. And the author wrote the book, Go Down Together, The Untold Story. There's always an untold story, but Bonnie and Clyde, the criminals, they were robbers, and all kinds of people tried to catch them. They were finally killed together on May 23rd, 1934. But it's interesting. I thought it would be a nice little diversion for us, and we hope you enjoy the show after the news segment, of course. Our show is dedicated to those energetic, tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and the world. In these tough economic times, some odd things are going on. Criminal justice necessarily is not being cut back, at least not wholesale across the country. But there are some interesting things going on, and one of those is that we mentioned the North Central Correctional Institution in Marion, Ohio. They happen to live in Ohio. They are hiring part-time prison guards. And you don't have to have any training. You have to meet all the qualifications to get the job. Then they train you. I think the training takes about 7 days. And you work weekends, and you get paid $16.35 an hour, plus I think some other kind of benefits, I would think. But check on that yourself. Go to the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections website, and search for the jobs, and they'll have that, and you apply for that, and they're going to go, they're going to fill this up pretty quick. So I jump on that if you want to be a weekend prison guard. I think I mentioned last week this probably beats working the fast food window at Wendy's, but I'm not sure. But you learn a lot about working in when you work in prison. So I say all the psychology majors should always go to work in prison first because everything sort of slowed down. Prisoners got time to think. Corrections officers, other staff, rehabilitative staff, they all have time to think. I don't mean that corrections officers aren't part of the rehabilitative staff, but usually they're thought of as security versus treatment. But anyway, take a look at that if you got an interest in breaking into the correction system. And these things are getting privatized here in Ohio. We're going to comment on what Director Moore said about some major changes during the news segment. He's the head of the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. Well, you're listening on the Blog Talk Radio, and we always want to thank Alan Levy for starting this thing. It must have who knows how many shows. I should find out. I keep saying that every week. But here's the chance for you, any person, any interest group, to actually broadcast live in streaming audio worldwide on the Internet, and it doesn't cost you one penny to do it. Isn't that incredible? If you stop and think about it, it's just incredible. It's sort of like, you know, if you want to get your own show, go ahead and get it. Like the Cheez-Its box motto is, get your own show, get your own box. So I think you can do it. And all kinds of people out there listening, I've talked to some of them, they have a reason to have a show. And they should jump up on there on Blog Talk Radio and go to work on it. And all these shows are archived, by the way, right after that. You can listen to the show as you're doing on your computer. You can listen to it on your cell phone. People listen to it on Skype. I haven't Skyped for a long time. I got tired of getting calls from people from the Far East at 3 o'clock in the morning. So I got off of Skype years ago, but I guess they've approved that. That probably used to be your phone number is kind of like available. Your computer phone number is available to everybody, and you got some weird calls. But I don't know anything about Skype now. I'll have to research that a little bit, see what's going on. But I know people that use it and are very satisfied with it. On Skype, you get to see the person's face when you're talking to them, and they get to see yours, if that's desirable. So anyway, here we go. Audrey, you have a blonde joke for the night? Oh, I like this one. Yes, I saw this one ahead of time. So go ahead, Audrey, with your blonde joke.
Professor Haley, this is a very funny blonde joke for tonight. I think our listeners will indeed enjoy it. A blonde government supervisor called in a subordinate regarding his failure to complete his last task. The blonde said, Sam, see, you only converted 4 out of the 5 books I asked you to convert to Braille. As you know, our state needs to make our publications available to everyone, including the blind. Sam replied, yes, of course. The blonde replied, so, what happened with that 5th book? Sam smiled and said, you mean the automobile driving manual?
Yes, I don't think you could drive if you are unsighted or blind. Probably not. Well, ladies and gentlemen, much more serious than that joke is the message from the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms. And they are against firearms. And they would like the criminals in the streets of Ohio and the nation to hear this message so that the crooks will go down and turn in their firearms and make our streets safer.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. That's a good message, and I'm sure that everybody's going to pay attention to that one. Ladies and gentlemen, did you hear about the great weekend that they had on Labor Day weekend? You know, in New York City, I think at the latest count, 71 people were shot. I mean, big weekend in New York City. So New York City's not happy about that, and they're going to be doing some things to prevent that. And generally, New York City has been a relatively safe place. And they got notoriety years ago and lots of acclaim for dropping their violent crime rate substantially in a period of about 10 years. Well, let's go for a green tip tonight. And I think this is a good one as long as, I don't know, Emily, are showers still legal? I mean, according to Esma Floyd in her little book, 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet, these are small changes you can make to make our greener world even better and last longer. And this is tip number 286, and it says, shower behind glass. That's right, it's a shower behind glass. When buying a new shower curtain, choose cloth instead of PVC, or better still, go for a glass door or screen, as it won't need replacing for many years. Now, you got to remember, because we've had a tip that says you should you shower? No, I guess you should shower over bathing. Showering, apparently, if you're only in there for 31 seconds, uses less water than if you fill up the bathtub. But if you're going to shower and you're going to use a curtain of some kind, then you want to get glass and not something that's made of plastic that would endanger the environment. And I wonder how long we can continue showering. There may come a time when, out of necessity, in order to save and preserve our planet, we won't be able to shower anymore. You'll be able to trace people better that way, right? like the scent dogs do. Okay, enough of that. So anyway, think about that. And Esma Floyd's little book is a wonderful little book. You can pay attention to that. Let's take a look at some criminal justice news now. And I want to be sure that we hear all the Bonnie and Clyde business. But let's take a look at some of these stories. There are some good ones out there. Some of them are rather involved. And as of late, we don't get into that too much. But we'll go ahead and start with this. Speaking of shopping, no, we weren't speaking of that, but saving the planet. This is a story right out of CBS in Los Angeles. And it said an effort to allow only reusable bags at Los Angeles grocery stores may sound like a political long shot, but one of the city council members there thinks the public, folks, will eventually warm up to the initiative. And this is Pete Demetrio reports just the suggestion of a ban has raised the eyebrows of several Southland shoppers, a shopping center there, I guess. Councilman Paul Koretz would prohibit all single-use plastic and paper bags in L.A. supermarkets and would require stores to sell or provide complimentary reusable or fiber bags only or risk a fine. So the stores would be in on this, too, in terms of the criminal behavior. Court said that while banning plastic bags helps reduce land and ocean pollution, the single-use paper bag still contributes significantly to the local waste stream. Some local shoppers, however, were less than enthusiastic when they were asked about the proposal. I think they can find a different way to make improvements to the city, you know, like stop the shooting and knife. Okay. It'd probably be good for the planet in the long run, but short term I could see it being a nightmare, one shopper says. How do we know it's good for the planet? I know we have to trust science and scientists, but how do we really know that going through all this? Of course, L.A. could make some money through fines. Just think about that. You could develop a criminal record for being caught coming out of your grocery store with a paper bag, disposable bag. It'd be just terrible, wouldn't it? But anyway, that's how things are going. There's some more news out on the Fast and Furious operation, which we've talked about here on the show before. Remember, this is the one that allowed the Justice Department, or the Justice Department, took all these guns and allowed them to be distributed into Mexico, and they were going to track these and find out what gangs did them and all that stuff. And they lost track of, I don't know, 1,000 to 2,000 of these firearms, and one of the firearms, well, more than one, showed up at the scene of murders in Mexico and on the border, and one of them showed up at the scene of the murder of one of our fine United States Border Patrol agents. But Mr. Holder says that that only he didn't know anything about it, but also other higher-ups in the Justice Department were not aware of the operation as it was being carried out. Then he says higher-ups, they say higher-ups in the ATF didn't know about this particular operation. He says all we're getting now is politics. The Republicans are holding hearings on this to find out about this. And he says this is just straight, why would we want to be interested in a, you know, an operation that went wrong, that ended up people getting killed and murdered, and we lost track of guns that we said we could track. They lost track of, I think, most of the firearms. Weapons linked to the program were used in the December attack along the southwest border that killed United States Border Patrol agent Brian Terry. Months later, Congressman Issa launched his committee's investigation
as the Justice Department's Inspector General also opened an inquiry at Holder's direction. He says, our committee is the Government Oversight and Reform Committee, ICE says. We're about making sure there is a system to prevent this in the future. But Eric Holder says it's all politics. You don't have to check into this thing at all. This is kind of interesting. Cook County, Illinois, one of the nation's largest jails, will start releasing some detainees wanted by the immigration authorities. That's a code word for illegal immigrants. That's under an ordinance approved Wednesday afternoon by the Cook County Board. The measure requires the county sheriff to decline immigration and customs enforcement requests, known as detainers, unless there's a written agreement with the federal government by which all costs incurred by the county are reimbursed. Now, why am I suspicious about this? Cook County, Illinois, right? Lots of illegal immigrants booked into the jail who might have either in their home or in their car, if they're living in where they might in fact have five or six different pieces of ID. Cook County, Illinois, where I think the President of the United States served at one time, right? He was a state senator and lived in that area and taught there. And these people would be out with their five or six different sets of ID during what happens in November besides a little snowfall? That's right, voting. They vote. So we could turn the illegal immigrants, oh, what a suspicious mind. I should be ashamed of myself. But Cook County says, we're not going to keep them anymore. If the federal government's not going to give us a way to pay for this stuff, we're not going to do it. So we'll have to see what happens in that particular event. Did you see the case where the Governor Kasich here in the state of Ohio, he reduced the charges against a woman that was jailed for using her father's address to enroll her children in a neighboring school district, saying the penalty didn't fit the crime. Kelly Williams Bolar of Akron served 9 days in jail this year for falsifying information on records that she used to send her daughters to Copley Perelon schools. She said her conviction on two felony records tampering counts had threatened her efforts to earn her teacher's license. Well, that's nice. She's going to work in the school system, and she's a two-time felon. Well, Governor Kasich said that was too much. He agreed. He reduced the convictions to two misdemeanor counts of the same charge. When I first heard about this situation, it seemed to me that the penalty was excessive for the offense, the governor said in his statement. In addition, the penalty could exclude her from certain economic opportunities for the rest of her life. Well, you can't do that. I mean, if you're a felon. Are we going to do that for other felons? I don't think so. I wonder if she knew it was against the law. She's going to be a teacher. She might know it's against the law, but she has an ultimate good purpose. Many armed robbers have an ultimate good purpose. They want to feed their family, not often, but they do that. But she wanted her kids to go to a better school. So Kasich is requiring that Ms. Williams-Bowler report for probation, serve 80 hours of community service, wonder what that will be, work full-time, not take any drugs or drink alcohol, and pay the cost of her prosecution. And I'm sure we'll be able to keep track of the drugs and alcohol as carefully as we do with all the other probationers and parolees. Kasich's order was a rare departure from the recommendations of the High Parole Board, which said unanimously last week that Kasich should leave the Williams-Bowler conviction in place. So here the governor goes right up in the face of the parole board and says, you didn't do good. He didn't say that exactly, but you know what I mean. Took a lot of courage. One of the attorneys for the convicted says for Governor Kasich to do this in the face of a unanimous parole board recommendation that clemency be denied. And we applaud him for that. I bet he did, said David Singleton, executive director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center. He said the decision will make it easier for Williams-Bowler to keep her job as a teacher's aide. Oh, she's a teacher's aide. Oh, they didn't say that till the way down there. I didn't even realize that myself. And ultimately to apply to have the conviction struck from her record. Prosecutors defended the felony charges, says Williams-Bowler willingly broke the law. You know, you have to have an actus reus and a mens rea. The act was that she, you know, falsified the document. the mens rea was. She knew what she was doing. She was doing it for personal gain or the gain of her family members. But anyway, we'll have to see what happens with this case. It's probably the end of it. She told the board that she loved her kids, and she would have done anything for her children. I hope this is the end of illegal things she does for her children, but very interesting kind of idea. Here's one that's a long story. I won't go with it very far, but because we want to get to Bonnie and Clyde. It starts out by saying, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's a crime-fighting blimp. A long time ago, I think back around April or something, we announced that Ogden, Utah was going to launch a crime-fighting blimp. Frankly, I haven't seen a blimp. Emily, Mike, Audrey, have you seen a blimp? I haven't seen a blimp in ages, but I used to see blimps around all over the place. But this is a 50-foot-long craft. It will be equipped with multiple cameras and operated by pilots by remote control. It would run for 5 to 7 hours at a time at an altitude of around 400 feet. So this could be the crime-fighting blimp. When first announced, it was January, I guess we talked about it, about an April launch, or maybe that's when we talked about it. But clearing hurdles with the Federal Aviation Administration proved difficult. No one else in the nation is trying to do this, so the FAA has no regulations. After all, they have to have regulations. And air safety is important, says Police Chief John Greiner. But anyway, if you look up in Ogden, you're out there on vacation or something, look up and you see this blimp over there. Just remember, it's going to have all kinds of cameras in it, listening devices, crime-fighting stuff. It's going to be a crime-fighting center. It's currently undergoing trials. It's being flying over rural areas. People be surprised. They look up and see a blimp 200 feet over the top of their house, and heaven forbid, I would, of course, it would be terrible, but it's going to be awful if somebody takes a pop shot at a blimp. I don't know, probably one bullet won't take a blimp down nowadays, but at one time, I think it would. He says, estimated the cost eventually to be well under the $40,000 cost of a patrol car, fitted with all the police extras, and possibly as low as $15,000. So you could get a blimp for $15,000. I think these police officers shouldn't jump onto this real quick, right? Because people are going to figure out we may not need you. After that, it's about $100 a week to keep it in helium and charge its electric batteries, one for the propeller and one for the cameras. It caused a stir when it was first mentioned, but wait, don't tell me. A new quiz show, and then the Jay Leno monologue talked about the blimp, too. So anyway, it'll be interesting to follow the blimp story. Well, that's it for the news tonight. I think we're going to go straight now to Bonnie and Clyde, and I hope you'll enjoy this little piece. They were, in fact, the nation was, I won't say infatuated, but the nation was enthralled with Bonnie and Clyde, and this is the 1930s, and it was a very difficult time in terms of trying to catch them and apprehend them, and these were some pretty serious criminal. So here we go. Give us time to set this thing up, and we'll listen to Bonnie and Clyde. And the book is called Go Down Together, The Untold Story. Here we are. Hold on.
Editor for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram presents a history of the infamous couple Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow. Mr. Gwynn contends that Bonnie and Clyde were inept crooks throughout their two-year crime spree. The event, hosted by the Kansas City Public Library in Kansas City, Missouri, is 40 minutes.
Thanks to everybody for coming out tonight, and because you've gone to a lot of trouble, it's cold out, it's starting to rain, and you're all hoping I'll talk fast so you can get home and watch Missouri get into the Elite Eight. And I think they will. So to start this evening off, you've just seen a movie that's magnificent entertainment and has become part of American lore. To write a book about Bonnie and Clyde is to enter into great controversy. You know, there's so many theories, so many rumors. And so let's start tonight by laying the worst, most vile, and untrue rumor to rest. I am not the twin brother of Warren Beatty. I give old Warren a lot of credit. He made a heck of a movie. And it's brilliant, and I like watching it. I'm sure you do, too. The fact remains that it simply extended the mythology of a story that, at its root, tells us an awful lot, not just about who two poor kids from West Dallas were, but the way our culture quite often rewrites history to fit what we want to believe, or at a certain time, we need to believe. It's true that I didn't intend to write this book. Books are like children. They grow up to be whatever they want to be. You don't have much control over it. My original plan was to write a book called Along the Tall Tale Trail. I was going to drive around America. I was going to go to places, iconic places in our country, or places where people who become a huge part of our culture were reputed to have done some things that perhaps they hadn't done. And I thought I'd start by going to West Dallas. I live in Fort Worth. Bonnie and Clyde grew up in West Dallas. I figure it's a short drive, and if I didn't really find them interesting, I hadn't wasted my time. After only a couple days, I called my editor, Simon & Schuster, and I said that this has to be a book about Bonnie and Clyde, because I was learning things that staggered me, things that I had never imagined before. I imagine some of you out here tonight are Bonnie and Clyde longtime scholars. We have Jim Spahn, for instance, who's done some wonderful things involving studying the Platte City shootout. We all know Platte City. It's the garden spot just outside Kansas City, where your airport is now located. And it's also where Bonnie and Clyde and their criminal career began to be extinguished. That was the beginning of the end. The thing that I thought needed to be done in this book, there have been, to my knowledge, 27 previous books written about Bonnie and Clyde that come from reputable publishers. There's probably three times that many self-published. And I've read everyone I can get my hands on, but very few have context. And by that I mean this. The great historian Stephen Ambrose used to say that he wrote books to answer one question. And that question was, how did they do that? And whether Steve Ambrose was writing about the Transcontinental Railroad or organizing D-Day, the purpose of his books, the thing he wanted to find out was, how was it done? Go Down Together is my 14th book, and in my books, I try to answer a question too, but it's a different one. What I always want to understand is, why did they do that? And that's where context comes in. And in the case of Bonnie and Clyde and the legend that's grown and been refurbished and reshaped, and 75 years after they're dead, it's still going on, it seems to me there's two whys to be answered. The first is, why did two kids from a terrible slum, who were among the most incompetent thieves that ever pulled a gun and said, stick them up, who were the antithesis of glamour, why did they choose, quite knowingly, to embark on a life of crime that would bring them fleeting fame but had to inevitably end with their violent deaths? They knew this was coming. They expected it, yet they were willing to have this happen. Why? And then the second question, why did America embrace Bonnie and Clyde? Why did they become national icons following in the footsteps not just of Billy the Kid and Jesse James, but Charles Lindbergh, Babe Ruth, Jack Dempsey? Why did that happen? So there's two parts to the book. If we understand them, if we understand where they came from, maybe we start to to understand the rest. Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker were products of a place called West Dallas that was a hellhole outside of the city of Dallas. The Dallas power brokers very much wanted to create a city that rivaled San Francisco for great culture. They didn't want riffraff, and riffraff was exactly what Henry Barrow, Clyde's father, was when he arrived in 1922 with his wife, Cumie. His three youngest children, Clyde, L.C., and Marie, looking for work because it failed as tenant farmers. The Barrows lived in West Dallas, not just in a slum, but in a tent city that was built in a marshy piece of land just on the west side of the Trinity River. It was pestilential. Adults and children died regularly from all kinds of diseases that they caught. The people who were luckiest lived in tents there. The Barrows couldn't afford a tent. They slept underneath the wagon that they rode in on. Food were sandwiches made, what we called then West Dallas round steak, which means bologna. And when there wasn't bologna, people were fed stale bread. On holidays, children were given oranges. Those were the only Christmas presents the Barrow kids ever got. They were born in a time when a man stayed in the economic level where he was born. If you were born poor white trash, you pretty much stayed there. And Clyde Barrow was an ambitious kid. He was a fine, gifted musician. He played the guitar and the saxophone. His sister Artie used to say that her idea of heaven was listening to Clyde play Melancholy Baby. He quit school when he was 16 and did what kids in, of his upbringing did. He went to work in a West Dallas factory for $1 a day and realized that was it. He could look across the Trinity River and he'd have those gleaming skyscrapers of Dallas. If he could scare up a dime, he could go to a movie and he could see people wearing fancy clothes and driving beautiful cars. Like every other kid in West Dallas, he wanted to wear Sunday clothes all during the week. Clyde was something of a ladies' man. He liked to date girls. The girls' parents wouldn't let them go out with trash like Clyde. Even other West Dallas families looked down on the Barrows because Henry Barrow was a trash man. The Barrows were the lowest of the low. And that was the life of Clyde Barrow, and he decided that he would supplement his income. First he started stealing chickens, then he graduated to cars. Clyde Barrow was a bumbling bank robber, but that boy could steal a car like nobody's business. In those days, a Ford would cost you $260 brand new. If Clyde could steal one and sell it on the black market, he might make $100. This is in the Depression. That's good money. So there's Clyde Barrow. Bonnie Elizabeth Parker, born in Rowena, Texas, a little West Texas town. Her mother, Emma Parker, is a social climber like you wouldn't believe. I'm sure in Kansas City society there are no ladies who are determined that their families will be the blue-bloodedest of them all. But Emma Parker was going to make that happen, and here's why. Rowena was a farming community. The husbands of all the other ladies who brought their children and husbands to the Baptist church every Sunday were farmers. Bonnie's father was a brick mason. The way Emma saw it, that made them royalty, and she raised her little girl to believe that. Bonnie's first mark that she ever made was made when she was 3 years old, when the tent revival meeting came to Rowena, and some of the little children of Rowena were invited on stage to sing their favorite hymns. And Bonnie got right up there, raised her eyes to the Lord, and sang the honky-tonk tune, He's a Devil in His Own Hometown. She got a standing ovation. From that moment, Bonnie's expressed desire in life was to be one of two things. She was either going to be an actress on Broadway, or she was going to be one of those ubiquitous, world-famous millionaire poets. She wrote a lot of poetry. When we look at it now, we see that she had a stuttering sense of rhythm, but she loved quotation marks. she used them every other word. So Bonnie's going to be royalty in little Rowena, except something bad happens. Her father dies unexpectedly when she is 3 years old. Though some people said he got sick and tired of Emma and simply ran off. We don't know for sure. But Emma Parker has to move with her three young children to West Dallas to live with her parents, and there the Parker family now descends into poverty. Emma gets a job sewing overalls. Her pay was about $7 a week. And Bonnie Elizabeth Parker, a bright young woman, faces this, folks. If she stays in high school and graduates, it makes no difference. There's no money for college, and for poor girls in West Dallas, these were your career choices. You could sling hash, you could work as a maid, or you could be a prostitute. Those were basically the things Bonnie had to choose among. She went for choice number four. When Bonnie was 15 years old, she married a man named Roy Thornton, who was just a few years older than her. Bonnie believed in the movie romances that she'd go see at the Bijou, and she thought at least if she married Roy, she would have a lifetime of poverty but of true love, except it didn't work out that way. He beat her continually. He disappeared for weeks on end. He finally deserted her. She never divorced him. If Faye Dunaway wasn't wearing a wedding ring in that scene you just saw, then that was a mistake, because Bonnie Parker wore Roy Thornton's wedding ring for the rest of her life. She was working as a waitress when Roy left her. There's a very strong possibility she was occasionally turning tricks, and she was not doing this to be promiscuous. She was doing it to be able to feed herself and her family. And then, 1930, January, there's a party in West Dallas. Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker both get there. They see each other. That's it. Everything else about them has been exaggerated or downright fictionalized. They were not great crooks. They were not glamorous. But they loved each other. It was a real love story. They were instantly attracted, and because of that, they were inseparable until 3 weeks later, when Clyde was arrested at Bonnie's house for car theft and ended up being sentenced to 14 years in prison in Texas. Clyde Barrow is 22 years old. He is sent to Easton Prison Farm, which is a hellhole. Prisoners there are treated like slaves, worked until they dropped, and it is in prison that Clyde Barrow kills his first man. Ed Crowder, a prison trustee who had been raping Clyde in prison for almost a year, caved his head in with a pipe. Not long after that, Clyde, who didn't think he would survive working in those fields for 14 years, did something a lot of other convicts there would do. Easton was called the Bloody Ham because to get out of that back-breaking killing field work, convicts would routinely take a hoe or an axe and cut off their own hands or feet. Clyde Barrow cut off his big left toe and part of another toe on his left foot, and he was crippled for the rest of his life and limped badly. This will tell you something about Clyde Barrow. He did that on a Monday. On Tuesday, he found out that his mother had gotten him pardoned by the governor, and he was able to go home. He limps back to Dallas, meets Bonnie again, makes lots of noises about going straight, but it doesn't work out that way. In those days, a man could be arrested for suspicion by the police just because they thought you might have done something and hauled into jail for questioning. The Dallas police didn't want a bad guy like Clyde Barrow back stealing cars, so they would make a habit of pulling him in just about every day. They'd take him downtown, interrogate him, let him go, and he'd have to walk back 4 or 5 miles to West Dallas, wherever he was working. And usually he would come back to get fired. We were lucky enough in writing this book to have access to two unpublished manuscripts from Clyde's family, his mother Cumie and his sister Marie. So we know from them that Clyde decided why bother going straight, it wasn't going to work. He and Bonnie decided to embark on a life of crime. They hated the way their lives were. They knew inevitably they were going to come to a bad end, but they thought it was worth it. I won't regale you now with the stories of what awful thieves they were. Suffice it to say, for their first big job, they ended up getting their getaway car stuck in the mud. They tried to escape riding mules bareback. They got pitched into the mud. They got surrounded by angry townspeople. Clyde left Bonnie there, ran away. Bonnie was arrested and held in prison for 3 months until a grand jury decided she was just some silly girl who was senselessly in love and had gotten pulled into sin, and they released her. It would almost be slapstick comedy except for one thing. People died. Bonnie and Clyde came from horrible backgrounds, but please understand me, there is no excuse for what they did. There were lots of poor kids who aspired to great things and didn't try to get them by robbing. And in the case of the Barrow Gang, they've been accused of as many as 17 murders by my count. 11 people died at their hands. And almost every case, it happened because they got themselves in stupid situations. The gang tried to shoot their way out in panic, and innocent people died. It was wrong they did these things. And yet, look where they were coming from. Why did they get famous then? Why did America embrace them? It's because inadvertently, accidentally, their timing was perfect. It's the depth of the Depression. Now, I want you to try to imagine something today that's almost impossible, okay? It's a terrible recession in 1932. People barely have money for rent. What they want is they want some kind of entertainment to get their minds off their problems, and that the industry that everyone believed was going to disappear was newspapers. Can you imagine a time when people were not subscribing to newspapers anymore? It boggles the mind. But that was happening. The media wanted some kind of stories they could print that would make people keep buying newspapers. The public wanted entertainment. The only thing going successfully were the talkies, the new movies, and Jimmy Cagney blasting people with a machine gun. And again, try to imagine a time where people thought the banks were the enemy. I don't know if you can. But if it's possible, work with me here. So in Texas at first, parts of Oklahoma and New Mexico, the papers start writing about the will-o'-the-wisp bandit, Clyde Barrow, who can disappear like smoke, and the glamorous young woman at his side. And it worked okay until the day in a place called Joplin. In West Texas, the way if kids had a nickel, one of their big, in West Dallas rather, one of their big treats was to go to Fair Park in Dallas, where you could get three pictures, a strip of three pictures for a nickel. And the kids would pose. The girls would wear these goofy hats and have parasols, and the boys would point those droopy rubber guns where, you know, the barrel would sort of point down at the ground instead. Clyde and Bonnie used to love that. And when they're out as real criminals in the world, they kept posing for these funny pictures, just like they did back in West Dallas, only now they had real guns. One day, in spring of 1933, Bonnie did just a salacious thing. The Barrows were traveling with a real criminal mastermind named W.D. Jones. W.D. was 16, and he was such a cold-blooded thug that he was afraid of the dark, and at night would insist on sleeping with Bonnie and Clyde so the boogeymen wouldn't get him, and that is absolutely true. To look like a big man, W.D. tried smoking cigars, big stogies that stuck about a foot out of his mouth. We're assuming he probably coughed a lot when he tried to inhale. We weren't there. We can only assume. But Bonnie, one day, just for fun, put her leg up on the bumper of a car in a rather unladylike pose, dangled a pistol from her hand, stuck a cigar between her lips. W.D. took the picture, and they forgot about it. A few months later, the gang is renting an apartment in Joplin, Missouri, where they do their usual dumb thing of calling attention to themselves unnecessarily. In theory, they're hiding out and having a vacation, but they keep parking a series of new fancy stolen cars in front. They come and go at all hours of the night. One day, Clyde's cleaning the Browning automatic rifles, accidentally pulls the trigger and fires a burst into the next house. I guess they thought the neighbors wouldn't notice. Well, the neighbors called the Joplin police, who immediately came to the conclusion there must be some bootleggers at work, maybe car thieves, and they put together a posse with minimal planning, tried to surround the place, and in fact, Clyde and Bonnie and W.D., Clyde's brother Buck and his sister-in-law Blanche got away. Two officers were killed in the process. And when the police went into the apartment, they found a lot of belongings and possessions that the gang had left behind, including an undeveloped roll of film. They got it developed, and there was the picture. If Clyde were here right now, he'd be firing a burst of the Browning automatic rifle, but it missed and kill other innocent spectators. Thank God he isn't here. In this film, there was one picture above all. This is how perfect Bonnie and Clyde's timing was. There was something newfangled that had just been started called the wire services, where a picture could run in a newspaper one day and be in every other newspaper in the country the next. And that picture of Bonnie with a cigar hanging out of her mouth was transmitted nationwide. Now, readers may have not known what the term Freudian implication meant, but they got it anyway. Within days, the Barrow Gang had evolved from regional rumor to national icon, and they were embraced. Country loved them. Couldn't get enough of them, and the media played to that by publishing all kinds of stories. If they were rumored to have been anywhere, that story ran as fact. And on it went, but not too long. There's a reason for that. In Platte City, not far from here, the beginning of the end came when, for the first time, law officers led by a great man, a great lawman named Holt Coffey, actually went in properly armed, surrounded the Barrow Gang. They should have been caught right there. They were trapped at the Red Crown Tavern, except an armored car, a man driving an armored car, which was actually a regular car with some armor plating, was supposed to be blocking the driveway. And he suffered a slight wound, panicked, and backed out. That gave Clyde a chance to drive free. Otherwise, all the things, Frank Hamer, that never would have happened. Bonnie and Clyde somehow, I think, deeply believed that they lived this long, evaded that many lawmen, because they were criminal masterminds. Nothing could be further from the truth. Most local lawmen were farmers or good old local boys who needed a job, got elected, were paid $15 a week. They had to supply their own guns, usually 22 pistols that they shot varmints with, and their own cars, often farm trucks held together by baling wire. Clyde may have been a lousy crook, but he stole wonderful cars, took great pride in only stealing Ford V8s, broke into National Guard armories and had Browning automatic rifles. So usually when there was uncoordinated pursuit, they could drive away from it, and if they couldn't do that, they could shoot their way out of it. Holt Coffey basically wrote the game plan for how to take them down, and it was ultimately taken up by the most famous Texas Ranger of all, Frank Hamer, in the end of January 1934. Hamer was a famous Texas Ranger who, at the time he agreed to come after Bonnie and Clyde, was already credited with killing over 50 criminals, being wounded 17 times himself. He was such a folk hero that his gun had a nickname, his sidearm. He called his pistol Old Lucky. And he was hired to find Bonnie and Clyde and put them in the ground. Hamer always told his troops, the best way to enforce the law is a bullet in the gut, and basically that's what he did. There's been controversy since whether Henry Methvin's family, the last member of the Barrow Gang, set up Bonnie and Clyde, whether the Methvins were coerced against their will. We got very lucky in this project by finding a man who in the 1970s had made a number of videotaped interviews with the Methvin family, so we now know what happened. On May the 23rd, 1934, six lawmen set up an ambush for Bonnie and Clyde, who had been tricked into coming that way by Henry Methvin and his family. The lawmen fired 160 shots. Clyde died instantly. The whole thing took 16 seconds. After Clyde died, Bonnie had just enough time to see what was going to happen. She screamed. She died. And as Ted Hinton, one of the Dallas deputies involved in the ambush, said later, when we were done, they were nothing but a pile of wet rags. And yet, they were even more popular in death than in life. 10,000 people attended Clyde's funeral, 20,000 Bonnie's, and they bragged, Bonnie's family, that the Dallas Newsboys chipped in $100 to buy a big bouquet of flowers for her casket in thanks for all the extra copies of the newspapers the Barrow Gang had sold for them. True crime magazines kept the legend going for years after that. 1966, Blanche Barrow, having served her jail sentence, is at home in the little Dallas suburb of Segoville. A man knocks on her door, says his name's Warren Beatty. Wants to do a movie about Bonnie and Clyde. All the other main characters are dead. She's the only one living. He would like to pay her for the use of her name. Blanche is excited. She gets enough money to build a fence around her property. Warren Beatty shows her a script and tells her about the wonderful actors who are going to be in the cast. And Blanche, who, forget the movie, was one heck of a beauty in her day, got the idea that this gorgeous gal named Faye Dunaway was maybe going to play her. Couldn't wait to see the movie. The premiere comes. Blanche struts in. She watches the movie. The movie is over. Blanche stands up and announces, "That movie made me look like a screaming horse's ass." Let's face it, she was right. Everybody in the Barrow and the Parker families tried to sue the studio. Judge threw out all their lawsuits, said that everybody was dead, couldn't do that, but Frank Hamer's widow won a large settlement because the movie, of course, tried to make it look as though Hamer had a grudge against the Barrow gang because it made him look so foolish, when in fact Hamer never even saw Bonnie and Clyde until the day he killed them. So here we are, 75 years later. The image burnishing continues. There's going to be a new Bonnie and Clyde movie, a remake. And I understand that that great, talented, serious actress named Hilary Duff is going to play Bonnie. I have heard from someone involved in the production. Read my book. I guess they wanted to ask me a few questions. I said, well, I hope this book is really going to stick to the history. I think that'll really sell a lot of popcorn. People will be interested. And they said, here's the thing. We're going to have a surprise ending. Yep. So here's the thing. Why do we write books about history? I think our purpose ought to be to have some record of what really happened. That's why I love to read about history as well as to write about it. Something that answers the questions, why did these things happen? I don't claim that this book is going to ever be the definitive book, because when you're writing about history, no book is definitive. It has some new things in it. Someday someone else is going to come along and find something I missed and maybe build on it. I sure hope so. Jim Spahn's going to be doing a book soon. I can't wait to read it. It's going to be wonderful. But we've got to try. When you write history and you weren't there, basically what you're trying to do is make the best educated guess as you can. If you read my book, I hope you'll notice there's 55 pages of chapter notes. Every time I say, I believe this happened, I want you to know why. Beyond that, when you read the book, I hope you'll think about this. Could Bonnie and Clyde be an excellent example of how, in our different times of trouble, we invent things that perhaps did not quite exist? We make people become what they want, what we want them to be, and not who they were. I think we can learn a lot about ourselves from what happened with Bonnie and Clyde. And meanwhile, the story goes on. They'll continue to interest us, to obsess some of us. That may not be a bad thing if we learn from some of the mistakes they made and some of the reasons we created some of the exaggerations that we wove. What I'd like to do, maybe there's some folks out there that would like to ask a question or two. This looks like a great crowd, and this is, I've been out 2 weeks, and I would like to be able to tell my wife when I get home tomorrow I got the best questions in Kansas City. You don't want me saying it was Minneapolis. We're setting up some microphones here, so So if you've got a question, why don't you come on up to the microphone so that everybody can hear you?
Yes, sir. I was wondering why they called it Platte City, Iowa. Because they were damn fools.
Thank you.
Next. Yes, sir.
Hi. I was curious on Blanche Sparrow because I remember when I saw the movie years ago, you just saw where she was in the hospital and then she just kind of dropped off the face
right.
of the earth. Do you know a little bit about what happened to her? And then was she also a consultant since she was the only surviving person to that movie?
Blanche wrote a very obscure memoir that's wonderful called My Life with Bonnie and Clyde. If you can find a used copy, you ought to see it. After Plant City, not Iowa, Buck had been shot. The Barrows fled to Iowa, where they were surrounded again and captured. Buck died, and Blanche was brought back to stand trial for shooting a firearm during Platte City, which Blanche always swore she didn't do. She got a sentence of 10 years in prison. She served her time, came back to Texas, remarried, and was a heck of a beer-drinking old lady who was known after she'd had a six-pack or two to start talking about how Bonnie was jealous because Blanche was prettier, and it could have been true. She sold the rights to use her name to the movie, but I promise you, if she had been a consultant in the movie, Faye Dunaway would have played her. Blanche did not appreciate the movie, and in her later years, you did not want to mention it around her after she'd had a brew or two. What else? You know, one of everybody's favorite stories about Clyde, because he'd only steal Ford V8s, is that he wrote Henry Ford a letter saying, you know, yours are the best, and while I've got breath in me, I want to thank you. There's one little problem with that. The letter was signed Clyde Champion Barrow. Clyde's name was Clyde Chestnut Barrow, and his family always swore, and they were probably right, that he would not have put a different name there. But I will say that Henry Ford thought the letter was real. He wrote Clyde a thank you note and sent it to General Delivery in Tulsa, where Clyde's letter had been postmarked. So Henry Ford, I'm sure, to his last breath, was going, boy, that barrel boy may have been a killer, but he had great manners.
That's an interesting little sideline, isn't it? Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight. That sounds like a book that would be an interesting read if you've never picked up anything about Bonnie and Clyde before, and like he says, there'll be more books, as there have been lots of books prior to his own. But Jeff Gwynn seems like he's done a good job on this one. Thank you for joining us tonight, and we'll have Vera Lynn sign us off, as she usually does. Good night.
We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies rise. The dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.